Vaidaber Moshe El Roshei Hamatos Livnei Yisrael Lemor Ze Hadavar Asher Tziva Adonai. Moshe spoke to the leaders of the tribes of the children of Israel, saying, "This is what God has commanded. Ish ki idor neder ladonai, o hishava shivua lesor isor al nafsho lo yachel divoro kechol hayotze mi piv yaase." If a man, really a person, takes a vow to Hashem or swears an oath to establish a prohibition upon himself, he shall not desecrate his word. According to whatever comes out of his mouth, shall he do. More on that later.
Hello, I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Come right over. Take the easy chair by the window. Comfortable?
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this episode is for Parshat Matot here in Israel. Recording and first availability, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 22nd of Tammuz, 5779, corresponding this year to July 25th. Let's do Tehillim Kuf Lamed, and then we'll get to the Parsha. Shir HaMa'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'Koli Tihyena Aznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im Avono Tishmaria Adonai Mia Amod Ki Imacha Hasalicha L'Ma'an Tivare. Ki Viti Adonai Kivita Nafshi V'Lid Varoho Chalti Nafshi L'Adonai Mi Shomerim L'Boker Shomerim L'Boker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai Ki Im Adonai HaChesed V'Harbe Imo Fidut V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara v'ashivyaho omidim b'bein bayam uvein bayabasha hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara liyirvacha umiafela leora umishibud legu'ula hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. The little bit of a cappella music that you heard at the beginning was the intro to the song by the Jewish a cappella music group called Sheer Soul. The piece is Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim. Different version of it we finished last week's show with. And I can't emphasize enough that the three-week period between Shivasar B'Tammuz and Tisha B'Av definitely speaks about Jerusalem. It was breached on the 17th of Tammuz. The Beit HaMikdash was destroyed on Tisha B'Av. But Beit HaMikdash and Jerusalem are a package deal, as is all of Eretz Yisrael. So here is just a reminder of our constant diligence in keeping Yerushalayim in the our focus. And I must say that it's more special to do it here from Jerusalem than it is anywhere else. And just a reminder that we follow the stricter opinion of music during the 3 weeks, and we stick to Shira Bapeh, also known as a cappella, also known in Hebrew as vocali. And as I said, you will hear now Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim by Sheer Soul.
Shoni olechi ki imlo eskerechi imashkachich Yerushalayim tishkach yemini tivak shoni.
We've been saying on and off since Pesach time. Because Pesach was Shabbat to Friday in Israel and Shabbat to Shabbat outside of Israel, we have a situation where we in Israel continued Parshat Shavua a week before the rest of the world, which means we're out of sync in Parshat Shavua. This Shabbat in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel, they will be reading Parshat Pinchas. We will be reading Matot. Next week, we will read Mas'eh, and in Chutz La'aretz they will read Matot Mas'eh, and we will therefore be back in sync for the following week, which is Parshat Devarim, Shabbat Chazon. It results in the same thing, but I want to make it clear that it is not in Chutz La'aretz that they combine two Sedras to catch up to us. it is we in Israel who split a double cedra in order to allow Chutz La'aretz to catch up, or enough for us to slow down so they will catch up. I say this because the system that we follow today was created in Chutz La'aretz for Chutz La'aretz, and it provided that this year, because it was it is a Shana Me'uberet with 13 months and few other factors that come into play, the plan was to have Matot Maseh read together, as it often is. In fact, it's the most often combined pair of sedras. We needed to slow down because we jumped the gun on that Shabbat right after Pesach. Chutz La'aretz is eighth day of Pesach. And therefore, we took the first double sedra to come along, which was a long 15-week period, in order to split Matot Maseh. And that's the story. Now let's get into Matot. Matot is fairly straightforward on the course focus. I think in terms of the microscopes we had back in high school and college, which had a course focus, I think that's what it was called, which just basically got your specimen into view, and then the fine focus, which really sharpened the image. Make that comparison with studying the cedra just on an overview, compared with getting into the nitty-gritty details of each verse. What you have in Parshat Matot is the first section, which deals with the topic of vows, oaths, promises, and any other terminology therefrom. The rest of the Sedra deals with the battle, successful battle against Midian, and the division of the spoils of war, and the settling of territory by two and later 2.5 tribes of Reuven, Gad, and half of Shevet Menasheh on the east side of the Jordan River prior to Israel's entering the land of Israel. Now, the two psukim that I read before, the first is sort of an introductory pasuk, which is Moshe spoke to the leaders of the tribes, saying, this is what God commands. The second pasuk makes it very clear that when a person takes an oath or makes a promise or a pledge or a vow or whatever other terminology you want, and sometimes it's not even a language of an oath, it could be giving one person giving one's word, or it could be just an emphatic statement, I will do such and such, or I will not do such and such. The Torah in writing is clear. Once a person makes such a promise, lo yachel devarav, he may not profane his word. Kechol hayotze mipiv ya'aseh, all that comes out of his mouth, he shall do. The Torah then continues. I think I have to correct something I just said. I'm checking. Okay, it's lo yachel divaro. He may not profane his word. Kechol hayotze mipiv ya'aseh. The next piece of that first section deals with two, let's say, exceptions to the rule of keeping a vow, both known as hafarat nedarim, not to be confused with hatarat nedarim. Hafarat Nedarim, which we won't go into in detail, is a father of a 12 to 12 and a half year old daughter, where the daughter makes a vow, and on the day that the father hears of it, he has the authority of the Torah to nullify it. It could mean that she promised to pierce her ears, or she promised not to do any chores in the house, or whatever the situation is. A father of a 12 to 12 and a half year old daughter has the power of the Torah to nullify her oath. 12 to 12 and a half, you might ask? Yes, the girl is called a Na'ara during that period. Prior to 12, her Nedarim are not binding anyway because she has the status of a minor. After 12 and a half, she has the status of full woman, and therefore her vows are her own, and her father is powerless to unbind her from them. But between 12 and a half, she has an in-between status of Na'ara, and Hafarat Nedarim of a father works. Similarly, but with differences, a husband has the right to nullify a wife's vow only on the day that he hears about it. Does not have to be on the day that she made the vow, but on the day that he hears about it, he has the authority of the Torah to nullify it. If he doesn't, it stands. And in this case, it's only oaths that have to do with him, that impact on him. That's the details I didn't want to get into now, so let's continue. Aside from the Torah's example of Hafarat Nedarim, the second verse of Matot, which we read, and elsewhere in the Torah, seem to indicate that a vow, a pledge, a promise, a word, whatever comes out of the person's mouth, he has to keep. Very clear. Kechol hayotze mipiv ya'aseh. So what happens? There's another part of this neder issue from the Torah. It is called heter nedarim or hatarat nedarim, the nullification of pledges, of vows, and it can be accomplished by the person who makes the vow appearing before a rabbi, scholar, expert in the laws of Nedarim, or before a panel of three adult males who constitute a Beit Din, even if they be laymen. And he basically is supposed to present an argument that had he had all of the situation clarified, he would not have made the neder in the first place. I'll give you an example in a moment. And the vow can be nullified. Now, where does it say anything in the Torah about Hatarat Nedarim? The answer is it's not in the written Torah. It is part of the oral Torah, the oral law. And it is no less Torah for the fact that it's not in the written word. There's a Mishnah in Masechet Chagiga, chapter 1, Mishnah 8, which says Heter Nedarim is floating in the air, meaning it's a Torah concept without chapter and verse being able to be quoted. And then the Mishnah continues with other mitzvot like Shabbat, which has a little bit of text in the Torah and huge volumes of detail from Torah Sheba'al Peh, and a third category of mitzvot that are very much spelled out in the Torah in writing. And the point of the Mishnah is it's all part of the Torah. You don't assign a significance to a mitzvah based on how many words or psukim it takes up in the written word. So now here's the wrinkle. There have been sects of Jews, including to this day, known as Karaites or Tzedokim, or maybe some other terms as well, who accept and meticulously follow the written word of the Torah, according to the way they understand it, and do not have a commitment to an oral law. What happens from that is that a person in this sect can make a ridiculous vow, a forced vow, any kind of vow, and it doesn't matter the situation, he must keep his word. And we, let's call us Torah traditional Jews, reject that notion because we have the combination of written word and oral Torah, and our commitment to Torah, excuse me, is strongly based on the inseparability of the written word and the oral law. And for us, there is a very important consideration when it comes to vows, and we see this in the full picture, and that is that what comes out of your mouth has to be what is in your heart. And if there is a discrepancy, you have a basis on which to nullify a vow. For example, a person gets on the scale and realizes that he's gaining weight, and he's angry with himself because he wasn't supposed to gain weight, and he swears or promises that he won't eat cake or cookies anymore. And this goes on for a number of weeks or months, and he's losing the weight that he gained because he's staying away from cake and cookies and probably doing exercise and other things also. I'm not giving a full picture here, so don't get into a knot. And the person, let's say, is at a party or at a kiddush and shul, and he absentmindedly picks up a cookie and makes a bracha and eats it, forgetting momentarily his vow. That person is in violation of a Torah prohibition of lo yachel devaro, just like another Jew, if he would eat piece of pork. For this Jew, a cookie is as non-kosher as any of the other non-kosher foods for the rest of us, because he forbid himself from eating cookies or cake. Okay, now, a couple of months later, he's doing beautifully, and there's really no reason for him to continue this ban as long as he keeps things in proportion. In fact, he actually craves the brownies that his wife made and regrets having made this vow in the first place. He can come and say before a panel of three or before an expert scholar, I said that I wouldn't eat cake and cookies, but what I really meant was until my weight comes down and until I'm back exercising and in proper balance of diet and personal care, I never would have said it. I would have stayed away from cake and cookies because that's what I should have done, but I regret having put it into the language of an oath, because when my daughter made her batch of chocolate chip cookies for the first time and wanted me to taste it, I would like to taste it. I don't know if I got exactly the situation that I'm thinking of, hypothetical, well explained, but the fact of the matter is that we can be unbound from vows that we didn't really think out all of the circumstances that were involved in them. A tzedoki cannot. There's an interesting Mishnah in the beginning of Masechet Yoma, which deals with Yom Kippur and the time of the Beit HaMikdash. Abba Kohen Gadol, where the Mishnah tells us, is sequestered to his office and office in the temple area for 7 days before Yom Kippur, where he reviews and practices all of the procedures that he will have to follow during that very special day of Yom Kippur, when the overwhelming majority of Avodah on that day is done by the Kohen Gadol. One of the things the Mishnah tells us is that the elders among the Kohanim, who would be interacting with the Kohen Gadol for some part of that 7 days, impose, administer an oath to him that he will follow meticulously the procedures set down to him by the Sanhedrin. He would swear, and then they would both go on their ways and cry. And the commentaries explain that he was being accused of possibly being a tzedoki. Tzedokim did not usually wear badges to say, "I am a tzedoki." So you have a situation where the Kohen Gadol, who in the time of the Second Temple was often a political appointee, valid as a Kohen Gadol, but coming from the wrong group of people, and there were clashes between the Sanhedrin and the Kohuna. And since we didn't know if this guy is a tzedoki, he has to swear to follow all of the instructions. So the question is obvious, and that is, if a person is coerced into taking an oath, it's unlikely that it's binding. And even if it is, he has the ability of hatarat nedarim to say, "I never would have said this in the first place if I wasn't being forced to say it." So who's to stop a Kohen Gadol, if he's a tzedoki, from changing the procedures at the very crucial point of the Kohen Gadol entering the Kodesh Kodoshim, the Holy of Holies, which tzedokim held was done one way, and Torah traditional Jews, Sanhedrin, directed elsewise, had to do with the ketoret, the incense, whether it was put onto the fire pans with the coals before the Kohen Gadol entered the Kodesh Kodoshim or after he entered, something that nobody was allowed to witness, and the Kohen Gadol would be all by himself. So what did they accomplish by administering an oath that he has to follow the traditional way as he was explained, if he could get out of the vow and do it the way that he believes is correct? The answer is, he's a tzedoki. If he's a tzedoki, lo yachel dvaro, he cannot profane his word, kechol hayotze mipiv yaaseh. He has to fulfill that promise, even if he was coerced, even if it means disagreeing with his sect's policy. Policy is not the right word, but we'll leave it. Now, all of the above, and I probably went longer than I should have on this topic, all of the above deals specifically with neder, But there is a point that I did mention that I want to make clear because it stands by itself and goes way beyond the specific topic of vows and promises. And that is the relationship between the Torah Sheba'al Bichtav, the written word, and the Torah Sheba'al Peh. The Greeks originally came to the Jewish people and forced, under pain of death, a group of 70 scholars to translate the Bible into Greek, because they did not like the idea that it was in Hebrew and that only it was for the Jewish people. They wanted the Bible for themselves, and they coerced a group of these scholars to translate into Greek. From the Greek, it's been translated into a zillion languages. The Bible is the number one best-selling book of all times. The other two that follow it, by the way, just for your smile, according to what I saw, are the Reader's Digest and Harry Potter. But the Bible, number one bestseller of all times, more languages translated. And the big problem with that is we are dealing only with the written word. The written word without the oral law is very often impossible to understand properly, and often can be distorted or perverted when it comes to doing something that the Torah requires or not doing something that it forbids. So if, for example, the tefillin of the head are placed bein einecha, literally between your eyes, then the tzedoki, whatever his tefillin look like, would have the tefillin shel rosh on the bridge of his nose between his eyes. We have an oral tradition that between his eyes means in the middle of his head, not to the left or to the right, but that the tefillin of the shel rosh, of the head, its front part is not supposed to be further than the hairline of the person. I might add the original hairline of the person, not necessarily the current one. And we say to the tzedoki and to anyone else of that ilk, by putting it on the bridge of your nose and taking the literal meaning of bein einecha, you are distorting the Torah. Now, that's a big statement to make if you don't accept the oral law. And that's exactly where this controversy comes from. If you accept the authority of the oral law, the authenticity and authority of the oral law, as embodied in the Talmud and further sources, as the true presentation of oral law, and that it is a package deal between the written word and the oral law and the Talmud and rabbinic law and a few other things that come into play, like family customs, community customs, chumrot, stricter measures. This is all part of what Judaism is. And if that's a lesson, I believe, that comes from Neder, because the written word is so crystal clear. You say something, you can't profane your word. You have to keep what comes out of your mouth. Comes the oral law and teaches us that's only if your heart is exactly in sync with your mouth. But if it's not, for any various reasons, then there is a basis on which either the vow is null and void on its own, or at least the procedure called Hatarat Nedarim, to unbind oneself from those vows which were not thought of properly. Person says, I love living in Yerushalayim. I'm going to visit the Kotel once a week at least. And he's pretty good, and he keeps visiting the Kotel. And two things. Number one, if 1 week he's not able to go, why should that be considered sinful in violation of his pledge? And you could look at it by saying, why did I have to bind myself with an oath? Yes, it could be to encourage me to go, but the point is, had I realized that there might be weeks where the weather is so inclement or I move away from Yerushalayim or whatever, that it's not easy for me to get to the Kotel each week, why did I put myself in that compromised position that I had to go no matter what? So there is a basis in traditional Torah Judaism to be matir neder, to nullify a vow. You can't do it to your own, but you can have a scholar expert or a panel of three basically do it for you. And then it's as if you never made the vow. But again, that's the vow situation. I want to emphasize again that our Torah is made up of two inseparable parts, the written word and the oral law. And that, to me, is one of the lessons that comes from the first section of Parshat Matot.
Kasher dibarto.
Belirush.
Daven every day all over the world. Say the words of this song that we just played. V'l'Yerushalayim Ircha Berachamim Tashuv, and to Jerusalem your city return in mercy and dwell in it as you have said you would, and build in it Binyan Olam, the eternal Beit HaMikdash, and restore the kingship of the Davidic line to it. A Jew who says that bracha in every single weekday davening if he lives in Israel, he says, return here to your city. If he says it outside of Israel, he says, God, please go there. It bothers me, always has, maybe not always, that Jews, religious Jews, who daven these words, who believe in these words, can be satisfied not to be here. Putting it a little differently the way than I usually do it. V'techezena einenu b'shuvecho l'tzion berachamim. May my eyes see your return to Zion in mercy. We say that three times a day, not just during the week, but four times on Shabbat and five times on Yom Kippur. And it is, please God, let me see with my own eyes the return and rebuilding of Israel and Jerusalem. A person who lives here, a Jew who lives here, has front row seats for this hopeful event. A Jew in Chutz La'aretz, I used to say, is like sitting in the back of the balcony, but it's even, he suffices it to watching it on TV. For anyone who's ever gone to a sports event in person knows that there's a certain excitement of being in the ballpark, in the stadium, in the hall, whatever. And it's different from watching it on TV or listening to it on radio. This is not connected necessarily with the Parsha. It's certainly connected with the Haftorah. And it's certainly connected with the 3 weeks and the upcoming 9 days of those 3 weeks and the culmination of all of that in Tisha B'Av, which this year the fast is on the 10th of Av. And this is what needs to be discussed by families and by communities and by shuls about some kind of timetable and plan to come back here. This is where Jews belong. When the Jew had no choice but to be exiled and was not able to, or very, very difficult to come to Israel, to the land of Israel, to Eretz Yisrael, whatever you want to refer to it as, then the Jew built an infrastructure for himself and his community to be able to do all the things that Jews are supposed to do, with the unfortunate exception of coming on Aliyah, because that in Galut you had no choice but to leave that concept to a picture on the wall and a song of Lashon Ahava. But all the other aspects of Jewish life were meticulously attended to. The question is for today, it's not an impossible dream. It is a very possible and practical and beneficial thing to do from many, many different angles. And especially at my age, when I hear of friends who have retired from New York to Florida or from wherever else to wherever else, the question is even more begging than why not retire here at least. I'm not in favor of waiting till retirement. I'm very thankful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to my parents and my brothers and my upbringing in Bnei Akiva, might as well give them credit too, for pointing me in the direction of living in Israel, for helping me live in Israel. And it's something that I'm very grateful I did almost 38 years ago and not waited till now. And then it provided me these 38 years of never a boring day, and a feeling of, as I said, gratitude that I was privileged to be able to come and to live here. There are many, many excuses for not. Some of them are okay. Some of them are not okay. And some of them need modification. But most importantly, Jews who are not yet here need to think their situation out and hopefully come to some good conclusions. I was thinking this morning of two-word phrases. And with this, I will finish. Besides one more song, and besides wishing you a Shabbat Shalom and Lehishtameah, two-word phrases. One. Okay, time out on that. Let me make sure, since I wanted that to be the final words, let's make sure that I remind you that this Shabbat, whether you're reading Pinchas or Matot, is Shabbat Mivorachim. We bench Rosh Chodesh Av. We call the month Menachem Av when we bench, which will be next Friday. And Haba Aleinu Letova. And that, you know, is something to pay attention to when you're in shul on Shabbat. Two-word phrases. Very different results from them. Very different in other aspects as well. The first two-word phrase was Na'aseh V'Nishma. That was shouted out by all of Bnei Yisrael. Ki'ish echad b'lev echad, like one person with one heart. All that God will tell us, we shall do. Basically, that was our statement of commitment to receiving the Torah. And we did it well the first time. And we've had our ups and downs since then. The other two-word phrase was uttered by Kalev ben Yefuneh, trying to encourage his fellow Jews to make Aliyah, where he said, Alo na'ale, I will go up, and let us go up. Let us make Aliyah. He was almost stoned for his statement. The people didn't want to hear it. The people panicked because of the report of the spies. And this created a situation of coming to Israel, leaving, getting kicked out, coming back, getting kicked out again, being oppressed, all tied in from this rejection of the call to Aliyah. Both statements, Na'aseh V'Nishma and Alo Na'ale, are not just historical events, but they are the challenge of every single Jew. Every Jew needs to say all that God commands, I will do, I will understand, and I will do. Na'aseh V'Nishma. Today, not once upon a time, a long time ago. And every Jew needs to be able to respond to Kalev, who said, Alo Na'ale, by saying, right on, I'm right behind you. And it's not a once upon a time thing. It's a practical thing today. I was talking with a friend earlier today about so many religious Jews. He basically said that a non-religious Jew has an excuse. But a religious Jew really has no good excuse not to come here. Because this is where not only are we commanded to come, but this is where it is Ritzon Hashem, the desire of God, that we should be here. More at some future date, Emir Tzashem. For now, I wish you Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah.
Me Rachel